Welcome to Tomorrow's Table Podcast. Today, we have an extraordinary guest joining us, Hassan Sabag, a visionary behind Nature of Sound, platform created by a survivor for survivors. His mission? To harness creative innovation and social entrepreneurship to drive real change in our communities. As a community leader, advocate, and survivor, Hassan has dedicated his work to empowering volunteers, artists, engineers, and fellow survivors to tackle critical social issues through innovation, impact-driven projects. His journey is not just about resilience, it's about turning pain into purpose and using creativity as a tool for transformation. Welcome back to Tomorrow's Table Podcast. I'm your host, Pokum Tianpit.
And I'm your other host, Amaya Martinez.
And we're here today with Hassan Sabag. He is the Anti-Trafficking Coalition.
Yeah. So the Solana Anti-Trafficking Coalition is something that I was able to recognize was necessary in our community. Mm-hmm. And so it really first started based out of the Solana Family Justice Center and working in partnership with the Family Violence Prevention Unit from the DA's office. I was really lucky to have the mentor that I had working there. Lori Frank was a really big part of my journey in getting involved in the community at this capacity. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, she passed away a few years ago. And so every year the DA's office recognizes the work that she was able to do in the community by hosting an annual health fair. Mm-hmm. So it's called the Lori Franks Memorial Fair in October. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that just to kind of signify or symbolize the impact that she had, not only in my life, but throughout the community.
Yeah.
That's really good. So can you tell us a little bit about your story, how you were trafficked?
Yeah, so my story is a bit of a complicated one. So I first experienced a lot of child abuse, mm-hmm. and exploitation in that capacity. So I had family full of generational trauma. Mm-hmm. So my brothers were all born here in the United States, and my dad was a single father. So in that circumstance, he thought it would be best to send his kids to live with his mother. And she lived in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And so this was during the 80s. And so around 1986, there was a civil war that broke out in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And so they were really young kids. So they had to endure witnessing the horrific situations and, you know, bombs, death. And it was a very graphic, very horrible experience. And unfortunately, they were stuck there for a while, and they had to actually get smuggled out of Lebanon into Syria, mm-hmm. to then make a flight to London where my dad could go retrieve them. Oh, wow. And so this was before my mom was in the picture. And so in the early 90s, I was born in 91. Mm-hmm. My dad met my mom, and I was born in Lebanon. But I was actually born, since my dad was a soldier, I was naturalized at the embassy in Syria. And so I was sent back I was able to come to the United States as a baby. And so I've been here my entire life. And with that comes that trauma that had resided in the home because of what my brothers experienced. And so one of my brothers, the one that was the problem child for me, mm-hmm. he had a lot of sexual trauma of his own. And wow, he was a cog in that cycle of abuse. Mm-hmm. And because I was this child that didn't endure any trauma or anything like that, he essentially, I don't know if it was conscious or what he was thinking, but he made sure that I didn't live a life without trauma. So very early age, he sexually exploited me, mm-hmm. and basically would try to blackmail me, saying mm-hmm. that he was going to tell everybody what he did to me. Wow. You know, when you think about it,
you're like, what the heck?
When you think about it back, you know,
something's not adding up.
Yeah, of course. I mean, like, with a mature mind, you can go, okay, this is what you did. Yeah. You're just going to tell people what you did.
Yeah.
But in the sense of being a young kid, I was like 7 or 8. No one wanted to be called gay or something like that.
Yeah, of course.
And that was
not
what he was insinuating, that he was mm-hmm. going to tell everyone that I was gay and things like that. Mm-hmm. And
he was like a mean kid.
He was a troubled child, for sure. He was very troubled. And he was more of a Jekyll and Hyde. He mm-hmm.
And I feel like what families, there's always going to be that one black sheep.
Yeah, I mean, of course. And so it was kind of a lifelong endearment with mm-hmm. him until he passed away a few years ago.
Okay.
And he never was able to overcome his trauma. He just continued to cause trauma to anyone he was around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was unfortunate because, you know, I don't want to like justify what he did, but there's explanations, but it doesn't ever justify what he did. He mm-hmm. had, you know, a lot of things happen to him, and it was just a cycle of abuse. And it's unfortunate because I never wanted to lose my own passion or my pillar of who I am, which is just to care and love and want to help people.
Mm-hmm.
So throughout his life, I always encouraged him to get help, mm-hmm. even through all these things. And just to kind of clarify, I actually disassociated a lot of what happened to me. And so there's a little bit more in the sense of what happened to me as a child. I believe he owed some people money. Okay. I remember some few details. It's still very vague, but I remember someone approaching my home with a gun and trying to break into the house. And I remember my dad grabbing a rifle.
Uh-huh.
And I remember this incident because I was in the garage playing. And me and my dad had this train set that we would always be in the garage. And the garage was open. And I remember this guy just getting out of the car and starts running towards the house. And so my dad immediately rushes me inside, and he's, you know, a veteran, so he's very, very fast at arms, and he was able to retrieve a rifle very, very quickly and get ready to defend his home. And we had a metal door, like one of those see-through metal doors, in the garage. And so he immediately got me inside, closed it, went and grabbed the rifle, and this guy was, like, banging on the door, and he immediately, you know, told him, "You need to get out of here." And I think that was the beginning of what was something more nefarious happening with my brother. After that, there was a moment where I was supposed to get picked up by one of my brothers. And these people showed up to my school and told me, "Hey, your brother asked me to get you."
Mm. Oh, wow.
And so at first I was hesitant, but then they knew a bit more information. Like, they knew his name and stuff. So I'm like, okay. So I go with them. And from there, it was pretty, pretty rough. I was beaten very badly.
Oh, wow.
And had a lot of sexual trauma from that instance. Uh-huh. Because they took me to an apartment that was kind of nearby. And I know I was reported missing for not 24 hours, but the Vacaville PD
got... I just got goosebumps, guys. Sorry.
The Vacaville PD got... involved.
Uh-huh.
And by that time, when they went to start to look for me,
mm-hmm.
I already had escaped and went home.
Oh.
But no one knew I was home because one of my coping mechanisms...
How did you escape?
I think I just saw an opportunity and ran.
Just ran. Yeah.
Yeah, just like bolted right out of there.
In that moment, you can't think. You just have to...
You just gotta go.
To get out.
Yeah, it's hard. Like, the memory is very... Like, it's very hard to remember exactly. I just remember... like the hot spots of the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like hiding in the bush and like running straight home because there's a lot of bushes in this apartment complex. And once I got home, I pretty much just hid under a blanket on top of the AC vent. And that's where one of the canines found me. They
uh-huh.
they got my scent, went right back into the house. And I remember just seeing this dog. And I love dogs. So I was like immediately happy. So
yeah.
Like, I kind of... disassociated what happened to me and just kind of...
And how old were you at this time?
I think I was like 7.
Wow.
Okay. Imagine a 7-year-old going through this.
No,
I yeah, I think imagine. I was like 7 or 8. It's hard to... A lot of my memory as a child is very vague.
Yeah, it's very vague. It's like a blur, right?
Yeah, it's... I actually didn't remember any of this for most of my life.
Mm.
It was like in high...
Because it's trauma.
Yeah.
So we try to forget the scariest thing.
In high school, I knew something was like... I knew I had some memories that weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
I would have like a lot of anxiety and panic attacks.
Yeah.
And it was just like a gap in memory. Like, it was just
so with
black.
All this happening, how long did it take you to even overcome? I mean, what kind of help did you get?
I didn't get any help.
There was no help back then, right?
No, I didn't get any help. And
this was in the 90s.
Yeah, this was in the 90s.
When social media and there was nothing out there.
And I think my parents didn't really know the gravity of the situation because, A, I didn't really talk about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I just...
Well, our parents, their job is just to work, provide.
Yeah, and my dad worked long hours.
Yeah.
And so there was a time, I think the closest they got to finding out that anything happened to me was when my brother was sent into a mental hospital. And he was like, I'm kind of glossing over a lot of the troubledness about him. Yeah. Like I my life was just significantly molded by trauma. And just even before I was born, he was already exhibiting a lot of dangerous behavior. I know one story that I've been told, this is before I was born, was he made this elaborate dinner for everybody. So all my brothers and my dad. And he poisoned the food. And
what, he was what?
Rat poison or something? I'm not sure. Heck? I'm not sure what he he did. And so my dad like had a feeling or knew, and so he just like I guess wanted to see how far the kid was willing to go.
Yeah.
And he like was prepared to watch everyone eat the food, and that's I think when he
did everyone eat the food?
Oh no.
No, of course not. Okay.
No, my dad knew. And so he didn't allow that to happen, of course. But he was trying to see, I guess, how far or how troubled his son was, and to see if he would really present the food and wait until they're going to
eat. So he never got like tested or diagnosed with any mental health issues. It wasn't much awareness back then, too.
No, he really didn't. He really didn't. He avoided help for most of his life.
Yeah.
Even as an adult, he was a big man. Mm-hmm. He was very big and like physically like intimidating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, he went to jail for a long period of time. So pretty much after my young adolescence era, once I became a teenager, he was out of my life.
Oh, that's good.
And so he was in prison and out of the state. So he lived in like Kansas.
So because of all this happened, it caused you to have a lot of anxiety growing up, right?
Yeah, I had a lot of
being
anxiety.
Being scared, being very quiet going to school.
I wouldn't say quiet. I was a pretty active kid.
Okay, that's...
I struggled with like communication. I struggled with like talking to like girls and things.
Yeah.
I had
self-confidence, being insecure about yourself.
Yeah. There was a lot of insecurity there. So my dating life in high school was pretty bad. but I found ways of coping. Music was a huge
aspect. Did you ever get any help in middle school at all?
No.
No.
No. I saw a therapist once.
That was it.
And it didn't pan out well. I remember the session. Because I remember I didn't talk about any trauma. I didn't even know I had trauma.
Yeah.
I just knew I was upset about some girl problems. And that was like all I talked about in my session. The one session I had as a kid. But after that, I remember in a car ride with my dad. And he was basically... I love my dad, but there's certain things that he did that were not the best. And so this is one of those moments that aren't a good representation of his fathering skills. He basically was like, oh, the therapist said you're crazy.
Oh, okay.
And that's why we're not going anymore.
Oh,
okay.
And so he wasn't like pushing anything on me. He was just like, the therapist said you're crazy. You're not crazy. And I think now looking back...
He took offense. It was like he went into a defense mode, like, you're trying to criticize my parenting. No, there's nothing wrong with my child.
Perhaps. Yeah. I think maybe the therapist said he'd do well with more sessions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's where the defense system came in, like, no, nothing's wrong with my son. Yeah. And maybe, you know, because of how...
And it's natural for parents to be defensive, but that's why we're doing this podcast, to educate other parents if they are going through this. Yeah, don't be afraid. Like, it's okay.
That... definitely is such a huge aspect, especially from, I come from a Middle Eastern background, and so mental health support and access is like minimum.
Mm-hmm. Ours too, trust me, I know, I get it.
It's a very challenging thing to overcome, and one of the main points is just like allowing generational trauma to persist and continue causes irreparable harm. I mean, just for me and myself and my story, if I would have gotten the help I needed at a much earlier age, I wouldn't have had to struggle in my 20s.
Yes.
And like, even now to this day, struggling with the trauma. And
the trauma with girl problems and all that stuff. You would have had more confidence.
Yeah. I would have had a normal childhood.
Yes.
Or as normal as it can be. Yeah. You know, at least being able to process what happened and not have this cloud over me and not understanding what happened. Because like I said, you know, I really disassociated and didn't really even recognize myself as a victim.
Mm-hmm. Most people don't, though.
I mean, that's a statistic even with human mm-hmm. trafficking in specific, specifically human trafficking, is like 80% or more don't yeah. recognize that they're victims themselves because yeah. they believe that they're consenting to this exploitation. Yeah. And I mean, that's how modern slavery exists in the United States. Yeah. It's not so much the myth of this person in a ski mask that's going to abduct you. That's like in Vacaville, the statistics and data and the crime alone is like non-existent. Mm-hmm. There's no reported like cases mm-hmm. of abductions in yeah. that capacity. There's coercion. There's where an exploiter grooms a child and finds a way to get them to isolate themselves from their family. That's something that happens. But from what I've seen and the data that I've seen from the law enforcement, virtually no what we call guerrilla tactics. Mm. And that's when they use threats of violence to isolate and force a victim into doing explicit acts. Mm. It's just, it can happen. I'm not saying it's non-existent, but it is not happening in Vacaville,
mm-hmm. yeah.
where it has been reported, at least since, you know, we, through the coalition and the work that we've done, there was not a lot of access to data. And so that was one of the things that we primarily focused on, is getting a good understanding of what's happening here in our community and knowing the types of reports that are being made, especially when it comes to demographics. Mm-hmm. And that allows us to scale, allows us to look at other services if they need to be scaled. Or...
Yeah. So how old were you when you finally realized...
Very.
I mean, was it in high school?
No, it was much later in life.
Later in your 20s?
Late 20s.
Mm. Okay.
I would say maybe even when, yeah, like 29, 28. I was already doing this work.
Oh.
And I didn't realize
that you were a victim yourself.
Yeah, I knew that this was something I wanted to do and wanted to advocate on, but whether I saw myself as a victim, I never talked about like the surviving of death threats and the violence that I yeah. had to endure from my brother. But the sexual trauma, I mean, I guess I subconsciously knew, but to readily have that memory of what happened to me and to really know exactly the type of trauma I had, mm-hmm. it was just empty. Like, I didn't really...
You didn't realize it.
Huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes it hard to... Like, I mean, this is the whole concept of how victims get shamed or blamed for mm-hmm. it, because they come out way later. And it's a lot of the times people just don't understand how the brain actively tries to protect you. Mm-hmm. So I actually had to do a no contact with my family. Not in the sense of, like, not talking to them, mm-hmm. but more of, like, they didn't know where I lived.
Yeah.
I only trusted one brother.
And you did that for your safety and for your mental health too.
Yeah. I mean, my brother that was my abuser and exploiter, he was spiraling to being incredibly dangerous mm-hmm. For me and my livelihood. Mm-hmm. And my partner and I at the time, we got an apartment in Sacramento.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we didn't tell...
No one.
Anyone from my family except one brother who I knew, who's my best friend to mm-hmm. this day and my biggest supporter and loves me unconditionally. He knew where
I'm so glad it. You have that.
Yeah, yeah, he was essential for my development. He kept me in the right track. There's a lot of times I was mentioning earlier that I used music as a way of coping because mm-hmm. I knew something was wrong in the sense of like my mental health. Mm-hmm. And yeah. so I actually DJed a lot when I was 16 and 17 and 18. I would go.
Hey, that's a really
good. That's actually really fun.
Yeah.
Good coping skills too.
It allowed me to be in a space that was positive. It allowed me to be confident in that skill set. Mm-hmm. So music really saved me in the sense of being out and going to experience a bit of life. Mm. But it also kind of brought me back into the issue because I was doing nightlife. And so this was like raves and events like that. Mm-hmm. And there is exploitation that exists
over there.
And I immediately recognized uh-huh. that this was happening. Mm-hmm. And that kind of gave me a catalyst to do the work that I'm doing because I knew that there was labor exploitation in the industry. There was sexual exploitation in the industry. Mm-hmm. And that really just catapulted me into the advocacy work that, mm-hmm. that I wanted to do, or mm-hmm. I needed to do for myself.
Yes. I love that.
Yeah. So what are some red flags the public should be aware of when identifying potential trafficking victims?
So I think the best thing that a parent can do
mm-hmm.
when it comes to protecting their kids is building their self-confidence, because mm-hmm. traffickers are looking for a child with low self-esteem. They're looking for people that they can fulfill a need that they want, you know, that they're having, maybe whether it's attention, mm-hmm. whether it's goods, like expensive products.
Just, believe it or not, there's more trafficking happening in Solano County than we think. I wasn't aware of it until I got to meet, forgot her name, but she was telling me a little bit about it. My jaw dropped and go, wow. And from then I kind of got scared to go out in public by myself for a little bit. So I only go like in the daytime. At mm-hmm. nighttime, nope. I stay home.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, there are, like, one of the big things, there's a lot of gray area. Of course, like, sexual assault can happen in those mm-hmm. circumstances, and that's, like, act of violence.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to say, like, you should be afraid of being kidnapped.
Yeah.
Because virtually...
Be aware of your surrounding, for sure.
Yeah, like, because virtually, like, that's not necessarily happening. At least the data and the crime show that that's not happening. It's really targeted towards getting you to be convinced that your exploiter loves you. And we call them the Romeo trafficker because they use love as the bonding foundation of their exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually consider them the most dangerous of all the traffickers because
oh, wow.
What are you going to do when you're telling your child you can't be around this person, they are harming you, when uh-huh. they say, no, he loves me.
Yeah.
And even for an officer to have that conversation, it's unrealistic. You're not going to convince somebody that someone else doesn't love them.
Yeah.
When they've already been through this whole, like, situation. And, I mean, this is when you really need to get into the psychological anatomy of a survivor of human trafficking and why they even seek help. They're not seeking security and safety generally because they've already lived through it. They already have been through the trenches of violence and harm. So when they're looking for freedom, when they're looking for getting out of the life, there's a whole different aspect. And so one way I like to get this this point across is when you look at what helps a victim of domestic violence in the sense of feeling secure, they can see bulletproof glass, they can see big metal doors
uh-huh.
as a sign of safety. They feel secure in a facility with bars on the windows and things like that because they know whoever is their abuser is not going to be able to come in.
Yeah.
But for a survivor of human trafficking, it's like they don't want any of that. I know I feel uncomfortable when mm-hmm. there's big locks and chains and things on doors. Because that doesn't make me feel I can leave.
Mm-hmm.
These survivors are seeking freedom and they're seeking trust. And so when you look at policies when it comes to shelters, a lot of the time survivors of human trafficking end up finding themselves in homeless shelters, which is like not the best situation, or they find themselves with a hotel voucher, which is where they've been exploited in the begin with.
Yeah.
So it's never good. No one likes doing that. But sometimes, you know, in this community, there's really not that many options.
Yeah.
What service
do you provide for situations like this?
So we refer to other agencies. So the coalition has been mainly focused on entrepreneurial ideas.
Okay.
And so we take more of a, I like to call it civic innovation or social entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we look at giving survivors the tools to become leaders, giving survivors the resources to accomplish their dreams in the sense if it comes in advocacy, and how we can have the community better support survivors' messages and stories. And it really depends per survivor as what they envision their future to look like. And so one of the most important aspects of the partnerships that we've been able to develop is we pair this with my own nonprofit. So Nature of Sound is a nonprofit I founded right after high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that I believed I needed for myself,
mm-hmm.
was a way of getting the community involved in issues that were pertinent. And exploitation was one of the main things that I focused on. And because being from the music industry and seeing how nightlife was unfolding, I wanted to be able to give musicians and creative people an opportunity to raise money against these issues that were affecting their art, their passion, their community, and their safety. And so that was really how it started, was really just focused on bringing people together, hosting concerts and music events, and raising money for those organizations in the community that were doing the work. So this is actually how I got connected with the Children's Nurturing Project and the Parents Empowering Parents group. Yeah. Is because we were interested in supporting programs that helped children with trauma, especially sexual trauma.
Yeah.
And the Children's Nurturing Project had a lot of services in that capacity. And so I remember Lori Hartman would come to some of our events and speak about some of the work that they were doing and how it's relative to the youth. And this is when I was like a freshman in college. And so I was going to Solana Community College, and we were hosting rock shows and dance music events to kind of bring awareness. And we would have like a portfolio of all the missing kids that are in the community, and like we would be able to have these conversations basically for the youth by the youth. And that was a way of bringing people together. And the first earlier iteration of Nature of Sound, eventually it started to evolve into how do we empower the community and businesses and survivors versus just artists and musicians and creatives. So it really just started to become more inclusive. It really started to find itself as a creative community solutions platform, so people can come together, look at initiatives and projects that they are passionate about, and be able to provide whatever skill sets that they are learning academically or passionately to kind of create these solutions. And that's really how we leverage volunteer power into the coalition, is because we're able to utilize that platform and get people involved to support initiatives that actually make a difference in the community.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's amazing.
Are there any specific success stories you'd like to share about an individual who's been helped by your coalition?
Yeah, I think the most important or the most impactful one for me is really just how conversations can really change people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so getting into this advocacy work and starting the work that I was doing and getting the coalition and being more more of an expert on the signs allowed a close friend of mine to recognize that they were being exploited and they were actually being trafficked out of state. Mm-hmm. Their boyfriend was using them to, you know, they were having them do like sex acts on camera and things like that. And
you hear that a lot too.
It, like, you know, with OnlyFans, that's a form of exploitation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a line of Johns going into a hotel room. Sexual exploitation can happen in so many different ways that it's kind of shocking. I mean, one of the new programs that we've been doing, or initiatives, educational initiatives that we're doing, is really focused on those types of exploitation and even how children can be approached by exploiters on video games. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important that we say, you know, video games are a great pastime. Mm-hmm. They're something that people find a lot of passion in. They can provide a lot of benefit.
Yeah.
But parents need to be involved in the sense of who they're talking to.
I agree.
And whether or not that there's somebody grooming them from information. Because there's an educational video that we share called Carter's Story. It's from the Department of Homeland Security. And it talks about how this kid, Carter, is playing a game, Fortnite, mm-hmm. and somebody starts giving them skins. Mm-hmm. If you're familiar, skins are just like cosmetics in the game, so cool armor, cool aesthetics, and things like that mm-hmm. they get to get.
Mm-hmm.
And at first he used this opportunity to say, hey, you're really cool, you deserve really cool skins because you're really good at this game. And so mm-hmm. they'd be buying him this trust. And eventually over time they say, hey, after they've learned a lot about them, they know what school they go to, and they go, well, hey, I know this girl that would like you. You want to send me some photos and I can share them with her?
Mm-hmm.
And then they would start to mm-hmm. create this collection that they can blackmail them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then that that can turn into extortion, or
that can go bad.
They would have them do things. And yeah, that it's a downward slope. And it's a lot of the same tactics.
Yeah.
You know, they're looking for somebody to gain their trust and mm-hmm. then to exploit that trust. And just to kind of go back on what you asked me. So one of my close friends, so she was being exploited. And because I was so engaged in having the conversation online and being a part of like what I was doing with my work, they were able to recognize and they actually reached out to me for help. And unfortunately, in her circumstance, her trafficker used heroin as a way to keep her in check. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really common tactic. So it's like the fishing line. It's because you know they might escape.
Yeah.
They might try to get out of the situation, but because they have a chemical addiction now that's incredibly difficult to overcome, they're going to come back for more. And that was what she was dealing with. And so she actually ended up getting physically beaten to a point to where she had to be airlifted out of state. Wow. So she was in Oregon, and they actually airlifted her to UC Davis.
Wow.
And so she had a cracked skull, and she recovered from the emergency surgery, she was homeless.
Oh my God.
And I remember I told her to come live with me. And I remember trying to get her services in the community. And I didn't know the gravity of how difficult it was to get services at the time, because I was just freshly getting into the more government and agency side of things versus just public outreach and education. So one of the things we were able to recognize immediately is they wouldn't deal with her mental health trauma until they dealt with her addiction. And she can't really deal with her addiction until she deals with her trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was this two-pronged issue that there wasn't sufficient resources. And to top it off, the medication that they were prescribing her to get through her her drug addiction is not something that people recommend for somebody with who's endured that level of sexual trauma and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
I can get into the specifics. They would commonly prescribe methadone, which is a common substance to help with heroin addiction, but it has severe side effects. And so typically people would recommend Suboxone, which has a lot less of a severe response with trauma. But she couldn't find any in the community here, and especially with her insurance. And so she ended up having to take matters in her own hand, which is not good, because this can be a slippery slope. And she ended up finding Suboxone on the street. And that's how she would get it. She would buy it off the street. And that was her way of getting through her addiction. But it's really common that can happen is Suboxone could be laced. And so that just causes a whole level of issues afterwards. But one of the great things that we were able to do with the coalition, one of the first things that we accomplished, is we were able to partner with Drug Safe Solano. So Brother Ray from the Matt Garcia Foundation, he was able to collaborate with us and find a partner, which I think is called Bright Heart Health, telehealth. And they were able to have referrals within 24 hours of finding a survivor that needed it to get Suboxone.
Mm. So, did she overcome her addiction?
She did. Yeah, so there is a positive story to this. She did overcome her addiction. She had a bit of trouble. She got married, then divorced, because her husband was a troubled person as well, who also followed the pattern of exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And now she's independent. She has a daughter that she's full custody of, I believe, and
that's amazing.
That's amazing.
Is it turned, so the whole story that she had to go through, there was a good outcome to it.
Yeah, there was a good outcome to it. I should have hammered in that point.
There's just a lot to cover, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially just going, glossing over my story a little bit and just kind of like the journey. It is a lot.
How does it affect you, like mentally and physically, hearing everyone going through it and then you having your own trauma? And I know you're using your voice and your life experience to be an advocate and give an advice, but does it affect you sometime mentally too?
Yeah.
I know it could be draining.
It's a lonely road. Yeah. And that's something I didn't realize when I first started, because making a nonprofit is one of the most challenging things. I don't recommend to a lot of people.
Yeah.
There's a whole process of like, is it better to just make a program with an already established nonprofit? And so it is a very lonely road. And I never really wanted my work to be about my story. That was one thing I had to overcome.
Your work, you wanted to be able to help.
Yeah, I wanted to support other survivors. Mm-hmm. And I was really blessed to work with really amazing mentors and survivors that recognized that I had a story to tell and told me that I should champion that and be able to share my story if I felt comfortable. And so one of my friends, her name is Nicole McCall, and she does, she was really active in our community for a while, but she was trafficked in Florida. So she had a big, you know, it's a really nationally covered story. She was abducted as a kid. Again, you know, she was abducted and forced into a circumstance with some of her friends, and one of her friends was murdered. Mm-hmm. So, again, you know, I did mention that abductions are rare. They are rare, but they
but
do happen.
But you do hear about it.
They do happen. Even in my story was abduction.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm data focused.
There was a story, I think, I don't know, I seen it, something about a van at Target, and there. I just kind of remember a little bit a couple years ago, they were trying to get kids. Did you hear about that one?
Yeah, a lot of the parking lot stories, I feel I'm a bit very skeptical of, to be honest with you. Especially with social media, people just have this desire to have attention, mm-hmm. whether it's harmful or not.
Okay.
And so I'm very skeptical about a lot of that stuff, because for me, I'm very grounded on fact. And if there's no victim, there's no story. Mm-hmm. And that's usually where I draw the line. If mm-hmm. there's no victim or survivor to come forward to correlate this circumstance and this predicament or this instance of crime, I tend not to believe it.
Okay.
Just because there's so much.
But it's just good to have an open mind, be aware, right?
Yeah. I mean, of course, be aware of your surroundings. Mm-hmm. It's just there is this irrationality that comes with. I mean, there is this whole movement of creating false stories about human trafficking. And I mean, you could go into the Wayfair conspiracy stuff, and literally there was virtually no actual victim that's come forward about being trafficked through Wayfair.
Okay.
And it was only the repurposing of real survivor stories that just so happened to have the same name as a cabinet in Wayfair. I don't know if you're familiar with what this is or what I'm talking about.
I heard about it, but not too familiar with it.
Yeah, so basically there was like people saying that they were selling kids through Wayfair, and because there was like a cabinet for $10,000.
Okay? Oh,
okay. And the cabinet is for an industrial warehouse, so you're going to get a lot of that cabinet. And so people would say it was named, like, let's say Vanessa or something like that. And so they would say, oh, you're going to buy Vanessa because that's the name of the cabinet. There's virtually no facts behind this. This is just
sometimes conspiracy. It's just rumors.
Yeah, it's just conspiracy theory.
Conspiracy.
That's
the word. Conspiracy.
Yeah, that stuff actually causes real harm, because then you have Vanessa, who got trafficked, saying, no, I was abused and exploited by my trafficker, who didn't work at Wayfair. It wasn't some corporation. So now you have somebody who's already overcome their circumstance and their trauma, having to revisit it just to dismiss false narratives about their story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing is worse than the repurposing of a survivor's story, because that's their truth and that's their pillar to champion.
Mm-hmm.
And so when somebody comes in to repurpose their story, it's incredibly harmful, because it's psychologically harmful. It's degrading,
mm-hmm.
and it's just shameful. I mean, I've never been gung-ho, and I am a very hot-headed person, just to straight up say.
Yeah.
But when it comes to this type of work, I have been very hesitant to anything that I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always taken a side of caution, because of an issue is so grotesque as this. Like, a crime is so... This is a travesty that is happening in our community. If we go in gun blazing and you're wrong, when are you going to admit you're wrong? A lot of people won't.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these people that post about Wayfair, they're continuing to post more things to this day. I bet they have new ideas of how to manipulate the realities of our world into different ways to find themselves interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll never admit that they were wrong. I mean, maybe one of them will, but these people who are bad actors online, they just... There's something about getting this attention, this dopamine response of controversial things that you post. It's really damaging, because it muddies the water.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're talking about something like this, clarity is essential, because you need to be able to have real conversations about the statistics of crime, how it's really happening,
mm-hmm.
and not be, you know, I don't want to say like not be fearful of the unknown, but like you have to live your life, and mm-hmm. you can't. It's like I'm really kind of hesitant about the Target parking lot stuff, because then we yeah. start thinking irrationally, you know what I mean? And there's probably a good justification, you know, why someone posted about it. Maybe there yeah. was something, like I said, sexual uh-huh. Assault is real. That can happen. But to say without any evidence it's human trafficking,
yeah,
it's really rough.
I like that advice.
I like that.
You got to live your advice, but just be mindful of your surroundings. Yeah.
You have to. Yeah, of course. Yeah. You know, never put yourself in a predicament where you can be, you know, taken. Because mm-hmm. It can happen.
Yeah.
It's just...
Stranger danger, right?
I mean, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's a great area, right? Where we... And this is where human trafficking becomes really challenging to discuss. Because child abuse and sexual assault can be aspects of human trafficking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's really hard to have definitive answers, mm-hmm. I believe, because it's kind of like it's a navigating circumstance, right? And there's a lot of horrible people out there that take pleasure in harming youth in the sense of like the same way I was harmed. You see somebody who has no trauma and they're malleable. There's this hurt people really. And that's where it's really difficult, because when we're not having the real conversations about how these circumstances happen and we live in fear, mm-hmm. we're not able to, I think, create positive change.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's very, all these information is just very empowering.
Really?
Thank you.
This is a lot of information. Let's see. Natures of Sound is described as a platform survivor by a survivor. How does it uniquely support those who experience trauma and hardship?
So thank you for bringing that up. So we have a partnership with a program based out of Sac State
mm-hmm.
Called MetaHab. And so mm-hmm. one of my, I'm lucky to call her a friend and mentor, Dr. Joyce Michael Flynn. She created a program that analyzes the psychology and anatomy of a survivor
oh, wow.
and gives survivors the tools, I mentioned this earlier, to become leaders and mm-hmm. to overcome their trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we talk about in this particular program is post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm.
And so any traumatic event, you have PTSD.
Yes.
You now have less capability, mm-hmm. less bandwidth than you previously had, and you're not able to tackle the challenges of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so what post-traumatic growth does is it allows a survivor to identify their trauma and to overcome their trauma and mm-hmm. basically say yes to life. And what's next, instead yeah. of the pitfall of why me,
yeah,
why is this happening yeah. to me, and why does this keep happening? So it really allows a survivor to analyze from looking at stories of other survivors. And this is really amazing, because when you're working with survivors of different trauma, like sexual assault and violence and human trafficking, if you put them all in the same room and ask them to talk about their problems, they're not going to really understand each other. Like I was mentioning earlier, domestic violence survivor will find safety and security in through metal doors, bulletproof glass, et cetera, et cetera. And then a survivor of human trafficking is looking for trust and freedom. And so in this unique experience, I was able to witness survivors of all types of trauma
mm-hmm.
find a way to have productive conversations amongst themselves
mm-hmm.
by looking at what other survivors have done to achieve post-traumatic growth. And so it was various different types of trauma. Survivors of the Holocaust, survivors of a plane crash,
mm-hmm.
survivors of murder, you know, families being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a way of understanding how the brain works and how they can utilize these tools that through scientific observations and genetic analysis and all types of methods that Dr. JMF did, they're able to kind of take what they are reading about and apply it to themselves versus sharing what they've been through and looking for ways to apply it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one important aspect is it doesn't replace therapy. It complements it, because you're not talking about your story.
Mm-hmm.
You're not talking about what you went through. You're just talking about the skills and tools that other people have used mm-hmm. and how you can use it for yourself. Mm. And so one of the ways that Nature of Sound plays a part into this is that we work with survivors who have gone through MetaHab. Mm-hmm. And so it really focuses on self-actualization, where you look at ways you can create a good mm-hmm. in the community mm-hmm. and really provide a solution. And so what we'll do is we'll use entrepreneurial skills to help make sure that we're able to help them with, you know, connecting them with experts, mm-hmm. getting them resources to accomplish their goals, and really trying to create tangible results with survivors leading the charge. And that is one of the ways that we're able to make sure that a survivor has the tools to lead, because usually in months, awareness months, where we have a survivor speak about their story, like January is Human Trafficking Awareness Month. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the times that's when most agencies are active about the topic. Mm-hmm. But what comes next, right? Do you just say, hey, we'll talk to you next year? Yeah. That's typically what happens. Mm-hmm. And so in this sense, it's like, okay, let's work on what we're going to do next. What do you think would help empower you? What do you think that is a service or a need that is required in this community that would help other survivors like you? And how do we make that happen? Mm-hmm. And that's the approach that we've taken and how it's been able to be an inclusive platform for survivors.
Mm. Oh, very good, Bex.
Are there upcoming events, training sessions, or volunteer opportunities for community members to get involved in?
Absolutely. So we have the Solana Rapid Missing Response Network. So that is a commitment that community members can make and businesses can make to share vital information about missing people mm-hmm. in our community. Mm-hmm. And so our goal is to make sure that when law enforcement have a missing persons case, mm-hmm. that we treat it like potential human trafficking, because we don't know it's human trafficking until we know, and it's usually too late. Mm-hmm. And so the goal is to be able to have a response from the community that's not based on an algorithm, so not focused on just being on Facebook or any of these type of apps, mm-hmm. but it's more of a direct call to action. So through email or text, mm-hmm. you'd be able to get this vital information, or you can share a flyer, or you can attend maybe a walk
to raise awareness.
Yeah, so we would be able to use drones and things like that. Yeah. Different than the walk that we hosted recently, because it wasn't about bringing
the community. The one in Vacaville?
Then. Yeah, it wasn't about bringing people together to find a missing person. Mm-hmm. That was just more of building the conversation and showing that human trafficking is an issue that needs to be talked about every month. And that's why the slogan we have for that is Solano, it happens here.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. there's this disbelief that human trafficking is a third world issue. And they really focus on mm-hmm. that gorilla type of trafficker that, you know, that stuff doesn't happen here.
Yeah.
and it's something I've heard by a lot of in my home community, because you don't get that same response in Vallejo where they see it happening on the streets. You know, they're not in disbelief of human trafficking. They mm-hmm. know sex slavery exists. They know it's a form of modern slavery, and there's not that much of a debate there. But in Vacaville, we're a bit sheltered. We're a very safe community.
It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. But there are websites that if you go on and you look at people that are in these hotel rooms, that a mm-hmm. lot of them are kids, you know, and that's something that I hear law enforcement tell to each other, because, you know, there's different fields in law enforcement, and some are more on the streets, some are more detective work, and some of them may not even believe it happens here too. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I hear that they say, you know, go check out this website. Mm-hmm. Tell me which one's a kid. Oh, and they're in disbelief. I mean, imagine law enforcement themselves can be in disbelief. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so it's really important that we have these conversations so that the public is aware of how this happens. They can protect their kids, but also we can hold each other in support of these survivors when they come out and tell their story, or how we can make tangible change in the community. Like the Missing Response Network, that allows us to collectively support a family in their greatest time of need. And the reason why it's so important to be the first to respond is we're also relieving the stress of law enforcement, giving them support, but in a tangible way that's showing compassion and care and love to a family that's desperate to get help. And the reason why that's so important is because in the age of AI, you're posting your missing loved one's likeness mm-hmm. on social media. Mm-hmm. You don't know who's going to see that. And if your loved one has a huge digital footprint, they're able to make AI-generated voice mm-hmm. and videos that can be graphic. Scary. They can be incredibly graphic.
Yeah.
And they'll use that to extort a family. And there's cases of this happening already. And I know that's not something that's happened here in Solano exactly. I know one instance is like this guy abducted this kid. And, you know, because there was a civil matter between the wife. And he ended up taking the kid and trying to use AI-generated videos to say that the kid was abducted by gang members.
Oh my.
But it was obvious enough to the law enforcement. It wasn't believable.
It wasn't believable.
That was, wow. Oh my God. Thank you so much for being here, Hassan. Your stories are amazing. Thank you for all your tips and advice. What you guys have been doing in the community. I mean, what you guys are doing, it's
amazing, truly.
It's been helping a lot of the communities out, and I didn't even know a lot of this stuff was happening.
I wasn't aware of it, anything, but now speaking to Hassan, I feel like I'm more aware
of
this, and it should be talked about more. I feel like the awareness should be more.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad to be able to share a lot of this. I know we kind of jumped all over the place.
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place, but we did cover a lot.
A lot.
Yeah, it's a challenge, especially, you know, going through the difficulties of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say we were hosting monthly walks, but month of March, we are just sitting a planning phase.
Okay.
But we are planning on April 26th to do an awareness walk in Rio Vista.
Continuing that sounds fun. You'll just post it on social media and then I can share it with the group.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. We'll try to make it.
Yeah, we will try to make it. Be there.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thank you for being there for the Vacaville walk last month.
Oh, you're welcome. It was fun. I brought my husband and my kids with me.
I saw pictures.
Yeah.
You guys look like it was really fun.
It's been such an honor and a privilege to be able to share my story and to try to give as much advice as possible in this short time we have together.
Thank you so much.
Aww.